Welcome to the All for Literacy podcast, hosted by Dr. Liz Brooke, welcoming established and emerging voices in literacy education and the science of reading. Explore with us the connections between literacy research, educators' knowledge and skills, and the implementation into classroom instruction.
You can change everything you want, but if the teacher doesn't get supported in what they need, the changes are going to really happen in the classroom, which is where the change needs to happen, right? To make a difference.
You just heard Dina Mortensen, Elementary Reading and Language Arts Supervisor for Waterbury Public Schools. Today, Dina joins Dr. Liz Brooke to discuss the impact of the hope-filled documentary film on the literacy conversation. Here's your host, Liz Brooke.
Thank you for joining us today on the All for Literacy podcast. We are coming together to connect new and established research with the educators applying those ideas daily in our schools. And as we work to improve access to the effective literacy education, it's essential that the information and conversation flows both ways, from research to the classroom and that classroom experience back to the researchers. So today, I am joined by Dina Mortensen, the Elementary Reading and Language Arts Supervisor for Waterbury Public Schools, and one of the featured educators in the documentary, Hopeville, How to Win the Reading Wars. So welcome, Dina, and thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Well, hello and welcome. Thank you so much for having me today as your guest.
So we always like to start these conversations in terms of what began your journey in education as a career? What led to literacy as a specialty?
I would say from the time I was a child, I always wanted to be a teacher. I played school all the time with anybody that would play along, cousins, friends, sometimes stuffed animals. In fact, I think in the documentary, Harvey included a picture of me with my cousins in front of an old school chalkboard that we used at the time, teaching a little lesson with everyone. So that was sort of always in my nature. But I would say we share something similar in the fact that we both started our careers teaching and felt that we didn't have enough knowledge to really be able to teach reading. And so I started my career in a town different than Waterbury, a nearby suburb. But I was a fourth grade teacher. And the week before school began, we hadn't talked much about teaching reading. I didn't feel very prepared in my undergrad program. And I asked my team, how do we teach reading? What's happening? We haven't talked much about that. And they handed me a box, an old copy paper box, emptied, but filled with Stone Fox books and a teacher's guide that went along with that. And I thought, dear Lord, I have no idea what this means to teach reading and what's going to happen if any of my kids are struggling. So that prompted me to start and enroll in a master's program to become a certified reading specialist so I can start to figure out how to teach kids how to read, and started that journey there and became very passionate about learning how to teach reading. And I argue that I'm still just as much a learner today. That learning has not ended. It evolves with the research. It's ongoing. But that really prompted a spark for me, not just as an educator, but to be sort of a reading teacher and learn that knowledge.
Yeah, I love that. I consider myself as well a lifelong learner because, as we know, a lot of people right now are talking about the science of reading, and people either feel A, it's new, or B, that it's complete. But we know that neither of those are accurate, right? It's science or evidence over the last 5 or 6 decades, and it's continuing to grow, right? There's new research out there every day. So I love that idea of being a lifelong learner. And unfortunately, you and I are probably in the majority of teachers. We know that so many undergrad programs are not teaching the evidence and the components of strong reading, although that's starting to change, which is exciting. But I'm glad that you found your passion in that you're letting the evidence lead where you go and how you try to stay current. And we'll come back to that in a little bit. But can you tell us a little bit more about Waterbury Public Schools, a little bit of the size and the makeup of the schools?
Absolutely. So Waterbury is a large urban city. And as a district, I want to say we have 31 school buildings or programs now all together. But at the elementary level, we have 23. So it's a lot of buildings and children that make up the learners in that population. We have about 19,000 students altogether and just over 8,000, closer to 8,500 in our elementary schools. I would say that in Waterbury Public Schools, we have an extremely supportive, and when you talk about science of reading and you talk about things happening, this city, and I say city, not just district, because it is the city, is really committed to reading achievement and to supporting all the teachers and the staff who do that work. So from our mayors to our board of ed to our entire central office, they very strongly support our schools and our student population here. We have about 20% of our students who are multi-language learners. And so they come to us from a variety of backgrounds, a variety of cultures. In fact, Waterbury is celebrated for having students or families that speak, I want to say the last count was 53 different languages Wow. here in the district. Yes. And in our overall student population, we're just under 80% free and reduced lunch Mm-hmm. For our students. And I would say we're at about 20% now students with disabilities that we service within the overall population.
Great. Yeah. And I think that certainly came through in terms of the community in the movie and how everybody Yes. is behind the schools and the students and coming together. I'd love to see that. That is such a critical piece. And we are talking about the documentary Hopeville a little bit as we talk today, but I also want to talk about things outside of the movie. But before we do that, what was it like to participate in this documentary? Can you tell us about that experience?
Absolutely. I mean, it was very exciting. We've been working with Literacy How for, oh my gosh, probably 20 years, and Dr. Margie Gillis. And in fact, when I went and back for my reading degree, and I was certified and I came to Waterbury as a reading teacher, I still felt like I needed to learn more, particularly when I came into this role. I said, there's so much and we're applying so much, but I feel like there's so much more I need to learn. And Margie and her team became my teacher in practice, even after a degree. And that continues still today. And so Margie had spoke to Harvey when he was looking for a place to sort of follow who's using the research, who's applying the evidence-based practices. And so she sent him to Waterbury. So I got a call from him one day. Then, you know, Harvey, he's full of life and energy and passion and is one of the most humble people you'll ever meet. And we had a conversation and he came to our board meeting and our board was overwhelmingly supportive to move forward with the documentary and to share some of the work here in Waterbury. And so working closely with Harvey and his team was an absolute pleasure. And fun. I mean, they're always making you laugh. They're always getting involved. But, you know, Harvey would say to me, who should I talk to? Who should we interview? Who should we? And I gave this man a list of people in the field he might want to reach out to. And believe me, he reached out to every single one. He found them all.
Yeah.
He went on trips. He even included me. I got the opportunity to meet Dr. Seidenberg not far from Waterbury here. He was over at Haskins when he did that interview. And so I got to participate in some of his adventures and meet some of the people face-to-face along the way. And so it was quite an experience having him here and documenting what our teachers were working so hard at every day, our kiddos.
Yeah. First off, Margie Gillis is amazing. I love working with her, have worked with her and known her for a while. And it's always important, I think, oftentimes we focus on what's not working or the story of reading failure in this country. And so the idea that Margie wanted to point Harvey to a place where you guys were actually following the evidence and seeing what it looks like in practice, I think was amazing. And I agree, just even working a little bit with Harvey, the energy and the passion and the dedication to this cause is so important. And again, I love that the whole community was behind this because I think that's such an important piece that it can't just be one school or one classroom, right? It really does start at the district level and you need to involve the parents and the community. So as a movie star now, we just had the Oscars not too long ago. Do you feel that your advocacy for students in this documentary Do you feel as an advocate? Do you feel like that's a natural extension of your career as an educator? Or how do you see yourself as an advocate for your students?
So absolutely. I have children of my own. They're 12 years old now, twins, a boy and a girl. And from the time they were born, I came into this position when they were about a year and a half old. And I felt like anything I put in place for the kids here in Waterbury had to be exactly what I would do for my own two kids at home, bar none. And so that just sort of guided my way, I would say. It was very natural for me. And at one point, as my kids got older, they had some difficulty learning how to read in kindergarten and first grade, and were in a school system that at the time was not able to diagnose and remediate some of those things. I worked very closely with them, and they were fantastic in collaborating and supporting those needs. So I advocate for the students in Waterbury. I did end up advocating for my own children. I advocate for kids within the town where I live still to support as a formal advocate. But I'll say here, and I've said this out loud several times to my team, we have, I should mention, a reading department here in Waterbury across the 23 elementary schools that includes 1 to 3 reading teachers in every single school. Many also have reading tutors that we bring in and train. And every single school has its own dedicated literacy facilitator who provides coaching to our adults. So we make up the reading department to support the evidence-based practices and support for teachers in all of the schools. And one of the things we say as a team is come to Waterbury, like, we'll advocate for you. And so the guiding rule is no parent ever should have to call and say, my child is not getting what they need. My child has difficulty learning to read and you need to do something about it, because believe me, we're on top of it. We have great data systems. We have meetings set up around that. We have collaboration meetings between our reading teams and our special ed teams every single month to go over our most fragile learners and developing goals and next steps and adaptations to their learning. We have it in place. And so that's really been our motto, is we'll advocate for you. And so I think, is that a natural extension of what I do? Absolutely, because that's the culture and climate here that we put in place, is to make sure the kids have what they need and to make sure the teachers have what they need to do that important work.
Yeah. And such an important piece. I've helped, I don't have children of my own, but nieces and nephews and friends' kids, and just different people over the years, when they come to me, I was a speech language pathologist previously as well. And so they come to me with some of their evaluations. And to your point, they're talking to their district saying, I need help. Like, how do I navigate this system? How do I understand what my child needs? And so I love to hear that you will advocate for them, and that the parents really almost don't even need to have that step in place because you guys do. And I noticed in the documentary, Hopeville, there was a focus on assessments and the number of days. I think one of the things that Harvey highlighted was the number of days that teachers, you know, once you take away the holidays and all this stuff, and how many days of instruction, and making sure getting in the testing 3 times a year and looking at that data. You talked about your data meetings and making adjustments to instruction. So what were some of the strategies that you used to have teachers adopt the idea of using the progress monitoring data? And it sounds like probably no, but did you get any pushback from either teachers or parents that this was, sometimes we hear, oh, that's too much testing?
So I'm going to answer that as a yes and a no. In the beginning, I did get pushback that there was too much testing right when I came into the role. And I said, well, let me take a look at everything you guys are doing, because there wasn't necessarily a dedicated place that had everything listed for every single grade level. And so we started an audit regarding what the teachers were doing and how long it was taking them and what was the information we were getting from that. And their plate was full. And then I found out, doing a little bit more digging, even more assessments were given in kindergarten because of the report card. And so the report card was driving certain data points that teachers needed to be able to put on a report card. Now, I'm not of the belief that we test kids for grades on a report card. I'm of the belief that if we're going to take instructional time, It needs to be quick. It needs to be easy. It needs to be accessible, and it has to drive instruction. And if it's not driving your instruction, then we're not using it. And I will tell you, I got rid of every single assessment they were using as a district required assessment. And I only included the DIBELS going forward. At the time, I think it was DIBELS Nets we were using. We've now advanced to DIBELS 8 and phonic screeners if we needed to dig a little bit deeper based on some of that data. Now, our special ed department will dig deeper and we'll use other assessments where needed. And teachers will have some informal spelling data and things like that that they collect. But as far as a district-wide assessment that's mandated at this time of year, everything was dropped. It was use your professional judgment based on what your students need. Again, we have the luxury of having literacy facilitators to guide some of those conversations in the schools to help teachers. And the reading department at large will help the teachers with some of the testing in their classrooms, even though we really focus just on the DIBELS and the phonics screeners as sort of district-wide assessments for our youngest kids in elementary. And some of the pushback I got was the opposite. They're saying, well, we can't drop this assessment and we can't drop this assessment. And one of the big things for us too was dropping level text. This was a DRA district at one point. And we were using that and the teachers were frustrated because kids weren't making advances and they were teaching them, but it wasn't necessarily aligned to what they needed because we didn't really have data or an assessment that told us what the kids needed
to
be able to. Exactly. And I said to them, you know what? You guys are just killing yourselves. You're spending between 20 and 45 minutes sometimes on an individual student. We started adding up all of the instructional minutes lost. And we talk a lot about what's the ROI? What's your return on investment? If you're going to spend all of this time on assessment, what are you getting out of it at the end? What have you changed for this child? And so really after that, there was no pushback. We got everybody trained. We continue to do training every year because we are a highly transient district with not just students, but teachers. Mm-hmm. And so we have, again, through the support of our literacy facilitators and reading department, we're able to set up those systems in schools to keep everybody trained. So it really, I have to say, it wasn't that bad once they saw the value of the data they were getting from it and how it was being used to drive their next steps with kids.
And I just want to applaud that approach and also highlight it again for our listeners. And you talked about doing an audit. That's something I've always tried to encourage people to do. I always say, if you don't know what question this test is going to help you answer, you should not give it. Right. And the idea that it's helping me answer what grade goes on the report card, to your point, probably not a good use of your time. But also when people do those audits, they often see a lot of duplication. To your point, maybe the state required something or the district, and they don't even know why they're doing it other than the state told us to. Right. And when you put all of those on top of each other, you see that maybe three tests are trying to answer the same question, right? Of who's on track or who needs more support. So I love that that's where you started, because we did a survey. It was about 1,000 teachers. This was many years ago, but between the testing, the scoring, entering the data, at the end of the day, and this was just reading, not even math, teachers were taking up to 20 instructional days across the year just on testing. And so if you can get some of that valuable time back, it's really powerful. And I love that even though it was maybe a struggle at the beginning, people have come around and have seen the value, because you do need that data to help you inform your instruction and change based on where they currently are. So in the movie, I believe you said something like, if research said handstands increased reading achievement, we would be doing handstands tomorrow. That was one of my favorite lines from the whole movie. I love that commitment to evidence. And so has that also been a journey in the district in terms of following the evidence so strongly? Do people say, well, what about teacher's choice? Yeah. It sounds like Waterbury's in a really good place now, but just similar to how you did with the assessments, can you talk about how that dedication to the evidence has been something that you've made front and center in Waterbury?
Absolutely. So getting that assessment piece done first was key, because once that was completed, there was a lot of value in the data they had. And the next question organically became, well, now what do I use to do with
this? What do I do about it?
Well, great question. Let's do another audit on our programs and our curriculum and see what we have in place. And then we can start to draw some lines to connect. What do we have? What do we need to dust off? What do we need to get rid of? And what do we need to order? And so that's what we did. We did another audit that was a huge audit. It took nearly a year because we have so many buildings and so many resources over decades, literally, in those rooms. And one of the things we found was that we had an abundance of leveled texts, which are great. And we use them all the time as part of our instruction and getting kids into some authentic text and some complex text. And we're always using the level that's specific to their grade level with teacher accommodation. So we sort of switched our focus based on the evidence there. So instead of giving a DRA and saying, okay, you're level this, we're going to put you in this just right book, we had a little switch there. And we talked about the evidence of using challenging text and making modifications or accommodations and reading grade appropriate text to kids because it has a much more complex language structure. And so we were able to keep those books, but we sort of repurposed how we use them based on that evidence. Another thing, we noticed we didn't have any decodable books to support any of our foundational skills teaching. And so we invested some funding in decodable books and were able to build a library of, I want to say, over 250 lessons. We built structured literacy lessons for the teachers, backwards mapping from the titles that include everything from phonemic awareness and oral blending into word reading routines, into decodable text reading, into encoding with phoneme segmentation and spelling. It's sort of our routine we follow, and we're working with those foundational skills. But based on that evidence, we purchased the products to be able to give the teachers those tools. And then the reading department was able to put together all these lessons. So if the teachers knew, okay, I have a group of kids here who are just working on their short vowels, or a group of kids who are starting to work on vowel teams, they have a menu of lessons that they can pull from, click on, and everything is right there, including the decodable book too, that supports that whole lesson. So one of the things we say is when we know better, we do better. And we got that from the Reading League some years ago. And we will certainly pivot when we hear something. And sometimes, and I think it gets a little overwhelming, sometimes frustrating for me, even within the science of reading community, there are discrepancies between researchers on the same side. And then that gets very confusing for a practitioner like me, who's trying to steer a ship of a large district and give one message. And so what I heard a lot of teachers saying, particularly my team, was Dina said. And so I said to them, okay, here's the new rule. No one says Dina said, because what Dina says changes based on that evidence.
Right.
So I said, you know what? New rule. No one says Dina said unless you can put your finger and point to it. So I started detailing all of our plans, our systems, everything, and whatever Dina says, and they're typically guidelines, things that we need to follow, that are best practice, particular curricula. But the instruction, that's the creative genius of the teacher. And so last week I was in classrooms going around checking out different reading lessons across the district. And it was nice because we have a scope and sequence that keeps a certain cadence. And different classrooms can be at a little bit of a different pace. But again, because of our student transience, we don't want kids to be transferring schools and then miss out on a key instruction, or to have it repetitive, because then there's a lack of engagement and behavior problems could happen. So for equity's sake, we have that cadence. And so what Dina says is in writing and in the plan, and this is the parts we're going to follow. But how you bring that to life, and what I saw last week in the classrooms, in second grade classrooms, completely opposite ends of the city, I saw similar content being taught, but I saw teachers delivering that with their own craft and their own art to it. And so I think there's that piece. Could I say that every single teacher is thrilled that things are completely handed to them? And we don't ever ask teachers to do something unless we pretty much package it and hand it to them, because they're so busy and because, you know, we have challenges in the district, and some of those challenges have to do with vacant positions, particularly in like unified arts and specials. And so if our teachers don't have a music teacher, an art teacher, not only do our kids not have music or art, which is a problem, but our teacher also doesn't have a planning time.
Yeah.
And that becomes difficult. And so the reading department staff works really hard to curate materials and curriculum and provide them to teachers and then go in and provide modeling and structures to support the implementation of that. But again, how the teacher delivers it is really their own craft. And so there's that fine line between, I want to provide you with what you needed at one point before we had, it was 7 years ago. We were coming out of a different curriculum. There's a shift. Actually, no, it was 11 years ago when we implemented a new curriculum that a consultant was brought in. Right at the time I started in this position, it was my job to roll it out. And the problem was it had a lot of great things in there. It was very conceptual, thematic, which has its benefits. It was written by the teachers under the support of the consultant. But it was missing foundational skills and particular materials to teach everything. It was more of a written curriculum. And in order for that to become a taught curriculum, the teachers need the resources. And in a survey, our teachers referred to themselves as hunters and gatherers. And we didn't want that. We want to be able to provide them with what they need so they can focus on delivering it and doing it, just doing the job, right?
Yeah.
Most of our teachers are very supportive of the curriculum. They work so hard to implement it with fidelity. They ask great questions. They give great feedback. And basically, their feedback on being hunters and gatherers is what sort of shaped our next steps in providing them with the resources that they need.
Yeah. There's so many amazing things in there that I want to come back to, starting again with the audit. I can't suggest strongly enough the idea of doing that audit in your districts and even schools, if your district is not quite ready yet, to look at your assessments. Think about what questions are we trying to answer, right? Do we have something to tell us who's on track or who needs more support? Do we have something to dig a little deeper that maybe somebody else, one of the specialists, gives, those types of things? And then with the curriculum, same thing, looking at, you might have had that great thematic one, but it was missing those foundational skills. So thinking about both, I think we maybe are at the point where people might be over-indexing on those foundational skills and need phonics, right? And we can't forget the language side of things, the simple view, right? So making sure our curriculum has both of those. But you also talked about two or three things, that the idea of teachers, and even though you provided them with the curriculum, they were able to put their own personality, their own craft into delivering the same lesson that you saw in multiple ways. So I think that's really important, but we're all starting with that same evidence-based lesson. So that's really important that teachers are not losing that ability, and that it's actually something that, based on the feedback, I'm all for teachers getting paid, but teachers pay teachers sometimes is not the best choice for evidence-based approaches. So to have the resources there for them ready to go, and then they internalize that, make that their own. But the piece you said that I want to make sure our listeners heard, because this is a challenge we're facing, is that so many districts have spent a ton of money on leveled readers. And what I heard you say, and this is the first time I've heard it put so eloquently and so spot on, is this idea of, A, we're not just going to throw those away and get rid of them, right? But you're going to repurpose them in a really thoughtful way. So the idea that you change to use them at their grade level as complex text for some of that rich language, maybe a read aloud, scaffolding, structured, systematic use of those leveled readers. I think for our listeners, that's such an important piece. And maybe there's other instances where you can think of to share, where that idea of, we've spent millions, in some cases, millions of dollars on these balanced literacy approaches or whole language approaches. And what do we do with it? Do we just throw it out, or how can we repurpose it? So can you think of maybe other examples of ways you've repurposed your prior materials in a way that still follows the evidence while using something you've already purchased in the district?
That's a great question. So I would say, when the resources are tied to a program, And that program is based on a different foundational belief and not necessarily, you know, as part of the evidence base. We typically do dispose of, say, the teaching manuals,
right?
So we'll get rid of those, but we keep the meat and potatoes, right? Books are books. And so we've had old programs. We had an older basal in the district before we had that in, I want to say it was 2011 or something that we had switched to curriculum. I forget the exact year, 2014. But anyhow, we still kept some of those decodables. Decodables have gotten so much better in just the last 5 years. Some of them we could even use for language comp, not many, but there are a couple that we've used that have some higher level, even vocabulary in there. But we've kept parts of programs like that to use forward. Some programs, one was purchased for special ed to use for intervention for students with phonics needs at the time. And the evidence base is this is not a good program for kids with phonics needs. It is a good program for kids who need extra fluency or comprehension support. So we kept it for those reasons. We repurposed the audience that had that program as opposed to just tossing the program. And we didn't stop immediately using it for any students who had issues with phonics specifically. And then there were other parts of programs that had these great little take-home books for kids. And so while we weren't using the program, the take-home books had some value for family reading time. And so we continued to send those home with kids based on other pieces of content we were teaching. Some of the books reinforced some patterns in those cases, but others, it was just good reading. They were more like a level text, but it was nice to be able to have them to send home so that families could read together and they had some guidance and support from teachers. And we still have some of those floating around and we'll send them home with our kids for that reason. So I guess most of the time I would say when we're saving the materials, it ends up coming down to the book. That's right. What I'm hearing myself saying here, right? Because there's always something you could do with books. You're just either repurposing how you use that book or you're repurposing the audience based on what that book or program might benefit the most based on the research.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it's such an important message because, again, districts are really struggling, right, with tight budgets. So I love all of that repurposing and thinking about maybe as a different audience or a different use case. So staying on this theme a little bit, and I mentioned it, how we often hear phonics is the science of reading equals phonics. Mm-hmm. What do you do in your district to highlight the need for focus on language skills as well as the foundational word recognition skills?
I'm so glad you asked that because the science of reading does get a bad rap for phonics. And I've always said that the people who hear that and may misunderstand it, it's because that's where the rub is in the simple viewer and Scarborough's rope, right? So what people typically disagree on is foundational skills in teaching that, whether to include it or maybe how to teach it. But no one disagrees on great language comprehension, instruction, vocabulary, all of that stuff. I feel like that's the part that was always taught in the reading programs. What was lacking was the phonics. And so science of reading is not about phonics. It's about all of it. It's just that's the rub because that's the part that's been traditionally left out. And so I appreciate you clarifying that spot on. As far as language comprehension, that's a huge focus in our district. In fact, we just went out, we did an RFP, a request for proposal to find a new core program. Our state implemented legislation that we had to have an approved program or we had to receive a waiver. And I don't know if there were 100 waivers, however many there were. I want to say it was like only 17 districts were approved that we were in compliance with the legislation and we were one of them. Despite the fact that we received a full waiver, we looked at, again, so I feel like this audit is never done, right? We're always going back. And I understand the pushback with Ed reports and the things lately that have been in the media. But one silver lining with some of that is it has driven textbooks to become better at anthologies, better at including some of the things that were important, such as language comprehension, specifically things with syntax that I typically never saw in anthologies and supports before. And a focus on building knowledge. That's been a lot of, that's been out there and has been, I see it coming out more and more in the last few years. And so despite the fact that we were granted a waiver, we went out to RFP. And in fact, right before meeting with you today, I was going through the quotes that came in and we're going back and forth bartering with price for our district. But we wanted a program that did a better job. And because there are better resources out there now than there were 6 years ago, the whole point of the RFP was to find a program that did a better job at building language for our kids. And so we looked at things specific to how vocabulary was taught, how it encourages teachers to look at cognates in words and to build word webs and concept maps and things like that. Like I said, 20% of our population are multilingual learners. And so mm-hmm. and a lot of the strategies that you use for multilingual learners are excellent for all learners, and particularly kids who need a little additional support with language. And so, and in reading in general, right, language is the basis of reading. So we're looking now at new programs to implement and new curricula with a big emphasis on that. We've had a lot of professional development earlier this year, and we've realigned some of what we're doing in tier three. It's easier sometimes for us to make the change there because that's my reading department and it consists of about 55 individuals, and it's easier to make a change first sometimes there, right. But it stems from a bigger tier one issue. And I found that we just didn't have the best resources in our teachers' hands to be able to do that. So we did find one now that we're confident in that's going to help us with building not just language at the sentence level, but science and social studies aligned to those standards as well. So our kids are getting some really robust background knowledge. And then it all comes in the form of PD, right? So how do we pull out particular phrases and then sentences and then passages that have a really good example of the structure of our language and pull that apart and mimic that in our writing so that there's reading, writing, speaking, and listening. So your question is so timely because that's been 2 years ago. We started a much stronger focus on that. And next year will be the full tier one implementation rollout of all of that curricula with new resources across the district. That's will be the focus of our PD as well, continuing that with our teachers.
That's great. Yeah. And the syntax, especially as the kids get older, the syntax is such a critical component of comprehension. And I think people understand the decoding or the word recognition, mm-hmm. and then they understand the reading comprehension. But even at that sentence level, the Absolutely. Syntax, just a single three-letter word, if it says a sentence and then it says but, right, versus and, just that connective word is so powerful in the meaning of the rest of that paragraph. So
it is.
I love hearing that and how you said language is the foundation for reading, right? Oral language. Now I'm putting on my SLP hat a little bit, but that is something that I think a lot of times gets overlooked. And so I'm so glad to hear that audit. And I think about those audits, really, it's like progress monitoring with our students, right? We don't test them once and then move on. We No. continuously come back, see if there's something new in the research, see how we can continuously improve. I get that we can't change our programs every year because of the, especially assessments with the data, but I love that audit. So we've talked a lot about what was in Hopeville, but if you had one or two things that you wish everybody, because it's being shown all across the country, which is amazing, what do you hope people take away from the story of the documentary Hopeville?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, there's nothing that's going to change student achievement more powerfully than the teacher. But it's very difficult for the teacher to do that job if they don't have support from leadership at the top. And so I hope that it's not just our teachers that see the film, but other district-wide officials in a city like Waterbury, we really are a department of the mayor's office, a department of education, that you have your mayor, you have your community, you have your board of ed, everybody that are in those leadership positions of power really take note and can check their ego, because the way I was trained in school and even for my master's degree, you know, in reading versus what I know now, there were a lot of opposing ideas there. And when you dig into that research and when you follow up with the experts and it helps you to see which path to go, it's so important that the leadership does that or puts their trust in the person to do it. Otherwise, the teacher is going to struggle to make that change, or the principal is going to struggle in their one building instead of a whole district of learners, or a teacher in their classroom versus a whole school. And that just makes it very difficult. So I can't say enough about leadership at the top to support the work, to be on board, and to recognize when you've made a mistake, perhaps, that's okay. Pivot. When you know better, do better. What's not okay and what's breaking my heart right now is there are certain superintendents that are just stuck in old beliefs and sort of use the evidence in a negative way and are really digging in their heels instead of saying, you know what, maybe there is something better for our kids, mm-hmm. and following that and exploring that. So the leadership is just key, I think, in everything that has to be done in the schools and making that change.
Absolutely. And that's where we started talking about Waterbury and the whole community and the district leadership, superintendent on down. I can't agree more. The more I'm in this, the more I'm realizing those professors were just teaching what they were taught. Like, it's this ongoing cycle. So it's okay. And that's why I think everybody is adopting that saying, which is so powerful. It's like, it's one thing, we do the best we can, because I actually was Googling that saying the other day because I wanted to know where the original sentiment came from. And it's this idea that we do our best with the information we know, right? But once we know better, right, that's the part. And that's what you're saying. We got to check our egos at the door and we can't dig in our heels. And that's why I think it's so important what you said, because some of these superintendents are the ones who sign the check for millions of dollars for these other programs. And so that's what you said today was so powerful, and hopefully they hear this, is that you don't need to throw out the materials, right? Maybe the teacher manual, but keep the materials. And then think about how can we utilize these in a different way, in a more effective way, right? Because at the end of the day, it's not about which superintendent brought in which program, but it's about the students. And so I love that idea of thinking about it not as a single person and what they brought in, but now that we all know better, we're going to do better. And so I think that is a really important message for our leadership to hear coming out of Hopeville. One last thing before we wrap up today. You talked about this idea of supporting the teachers. And so we've both talked about how we were not able to obtain that information in our undergrad programs. You talked a lot about some of the materials that you have created. You talked about the amazing reading team you have in each school. But what are some of the other things you've done to support your teachers getting that knowledge in the science of reading in Waterbury?
Thank you for asking that, because you asked me what two things do I hope people get. And one is the leadership. And secondary to that, or even as part of that, is the support that you provide for teachers. So you can change everything you want, but if the teacher doesn't get supported in what they need, the changes that are going to really happen in the classroom, which is where the change needs to happen, right, to make a difference. And so, yes, one of the things we advocated for were the literacy coaches. They were split across buildings. We advocated some years ago for full-time coaches in each of the buildings. And I get to meet with those coaches weekly. I also meet with the principals weekly after I meet with the coaches to make sure they're on board with everything we're doing and what the coaches received in that training. And that's the whole reading department gets its own separate reading training to really stay on top of the field, because they're the ones servicing our neediest learners. So it's kind of two-pronged here, supporting the reading staff and then also supporting the reading staff to support, particularly the facilitators, our classroom teachers. And so, yes, we have your traditional professional development days, and we have early release days where there's some more PD. And that's sort of like, your workshop model where you're delivering information and sometimes you get into it. But one of the biggest things I would say we do for teachers in supporting these implementations is really, it's twofold. They meet weekly as instructional data teams, collaborative teams. And those meetings are led by the literacy facilitator in the meeting. So they're there to pull up the plans, to go through the resources, to explain, to model, and to go over the rationale of what we're doing and why. Because if our teachers don't understand that rationale and why, it's really hard to change adult behavior when people don't say, well, why do I need to do this anyway? How is this going to impact? How is this change in practice going to impact my students? And so we have a literacy facilitator there to guide those conversations and to explain something, to model. We do a lot of videotapes. Many of our classroom teachers have been so gracious that they'll allow me to come in and videotape them to share segments with the rest of the district. And so we have some in-house stars here themselves the center of the film, to be able to share that ongoing practice with teachers. But most importantly, our literacy facilitators then follow up with in-class coaching. And that's a game changer, because they'll go in, they'll model something, but in that same coaching cycle, the teacher then delivers whatever that strategy is, that content or whatnot, right there in that cycle. So you didn't want to waste any time anymore. Instead of, I come in this week and then I'll come back next week. Oh, no, no. We're going to go in for 45 minutes. I'm going to model this part. You model it back. And then there's that immediate feedback between the coach and the teacher. The principals are not a part of that. It's private time for the coach and the teachers to build those relationships. It's not a gotcha. Our facilitators are not evaluators. Mm-hmm. They're there just to support the teachers.
So important.
It is. Mm-hmm. And being able to support them in the context of their classroom with their kids makes it applicable to what they're doing every day. It's not a video that came from a publisher that shows this utopic classroom and everything is perfect and there are butterflies outside the window. Like, that doesn't always happen. And so when our facilitators are there to go into their walls and work with their materials and their kids and the things that we're trying to roll out, to follow up what was done in a workshop, to follow up what was done in a team meeting, it brings it to life. It makes it applicable, and it gives the teacher that differentiation that they need to push their practice to the next level, make a small mm-hmm. tweak, or even have just an aha moment there. So I would say that's probably one of our strongest pieces there, is that coaching element and that dedicated building level support.
Yeah. And it is so important. The idyllic videos that often come with different programs. So here is a question, and you might need more time to think about this. This is not like a gotcha question or anything, but how do some districts, like, is there any way to think about coaching? There's nothing better than the in-classroom coaching you just described, right? With their own students, their own classroom, the teacher can then follow up. Is there a way you could think about that if a district can't afford that? If people are trying to think about, is there any hybrid between a videotape of this utopian classroom and having a coach in every school? Is there any virtual aspects of coaching that you can think of that would be valuable if the district can't afford coaches? Even though we know, again, to your point, the situation you described, I think, is our ideal.
So absolutely. And that's a fantastic question. So first and foremost, you just have stars in every single building in your classroom teachers. You have your early adopters, you have your ones who get into the science, whether you're into it or not, and they follow through. So I would capitalize on those individuals and using them as models and guides. And so it's cheaper to probably have a substitute for a day that can cover classrooms, so that a classroom teacher could maybe go and model in a peer's classroom and provide some feedback. And of course, that's going to depend on the relationships and dynamics in the building. But that can go a long way, even in having substitutes to have classroom teachers visit other teachers' classrooms. We did this last week with two schools across the district. One teacher said, I've been here 21 years. This is the first time I ever got to go to another first grade classroom and see what was happening. And the reason they brought the team there is because they said, oh no, what you're asking us to do in 20 minutes, this just can't be done. This cannot be done in a first grade. There's not enough time. We don't have this. And so we said, okay, we're going to take you on a field trip. And we brought them and their jaws dropped, and it just made it, you know, an instant change. It was great PD for them, but that had nothing to do with a literacy facilitator. That had to do with a team who put a plan together, one principal working with another principal and bringing teams over to be able to see things. And action is great coaching. Yes, you can also have somebody in the building who can take videotapes of these lessons and share them with everyone else. But that part of coaching falls short of giving feedback. So it provides great models, and they're great in context models of your particular district, demographic, whatever it is you're working with. But the change in teacher practice comes not necessarily from watching somebody do it in your classroom, but from you doing it, realizing where you might have gone off track or had a misunderstanding, because you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. And then you have somebody give you that feedback, and then that light bulb goes off and you really never forget it. So online coaching, virtual coaching is definitely a viable option. And we've been doing that here the last 2 years. We got savvy since right. the pandemic with our skills.
Technology,
our virtual
capabilities
skills.
Have changed.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, we have this twofold approach where we have to support the reading department and we also have to support the teachers. And so we partner with an organization called Hill for Literacy and Literacy High, you know, Margie's organization. And sometimes they will watch a lesson virtually, and then the teacher comes back over once the kids are dismissed and they meet with that coach virtually to share that, or they'll pre-record their lesson. They send it to the coach, and then the coach, they set a defined time to meet, whether it's in person or virtual, and the coach gives them feedback. And that's that key piece right there, is to have that feedback. And that's a fraction of the cost of having a full-time literacy facilitator in your building, and another way to be able to get that good model, but the follow-up feedback to make the change.
The feedback is critical. Yeah, no, I love those ideas. And it's funny that you said about the first grade teachers, because I think on a previous podcast, I mentioned I taught next door and across the hall from two teachers who had been teaching first grade for 25 years, and I was brand new to teaching. I never once saw them teach, right? And so that idea of, and that was just literally next door, not across town, but I love that idea of, we all have stars and experts in our building. And I don't think we often leverage that expertise and have people observe their peers. And what you said earlier is really important too. It's not an accountability way or a punitive way or an evaluative way. There's time for those types of observations as well. But this idea for coaching and support, it's not to present a peer is going to observe me to give my performance review type of thing. So I really appreciate you thinking about all of those various ways. And with the virtual coaching, the key is to follow up and get that feedback, just like we would want to do with the students. So I really love all of these practical ideas, Dina, and so appreciative of your time. I guess as we close, there's plenty of challenges out there related to reading and classrooms, but also tremendous forward momentum. So what makes you most hopeful for the future of literacy, both in Waterbury and across the country?
Well, certainly the movement that's been growing over the last few years and this sort of awareness that people are having, and the awareness, to your point earlier, that it's not just about the phonics, it's about the language comp, and particularly in a large urban district like this, it's probably even more important. It just can't be forgotten. You have to have both. And so I'm hopeful that people will see the documentary and the other films that are out there and the different pieces of legislation that are being passed all over the country. It brings attention and it brings an urgency to it that creates an advocacy in and of itself for everyone. So my hope is that the word gets out there and that the people at the top start to ask questions and either take initiative themselves or empower those to take those steps and make those changes for kids. I mean, as a person who oversees a reading program here and advocates daily, but also as a parent who dealt with children who needed some support learning how to read. I mean, these are kids who grew up with a phonics poster in their kitchen at the age of two. And we were talking big. There was no baby talk in my house. I mean, we used full-on vocabulary with them from a young age. And even with all of that, they still needed support with learning how to read. They needed a systematic, explicit approach. And their mom is a reading specialist and supervisor. Mm-hmm. So you have those kids that are out there and need that help with reading and with spelling. With letter formation is another thing we didn't talk too much about, but it's important. And so I'm just hoping that the districts who necessarily aren't following the evidence base have sort of an aha moment, take a deeper look, and start with making one small change tomorrow.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dina. Again, I learned so much from you today. I hope our listeners learned so much from you today. And I know you have such a busy schedule. So we really thank you for taking the time to meet with us.
My pleasure. It was an honor being here with you today. Thank you for your discussion and for sharing stories of Waterbury Public Schools. And I hope all the listeners have some great takeaways and can help reach out and help students one day at a time here.
Absolutely. And thank you to our listeners for joining Dina and me today. There is so much we can learn by speaking directly to our educators in the classrooms nationwide and partnering with advocates like those behind the Hope-Filled documentary. I'd love to hear from our listeners. What advocacy conversations are happening in your community today? Let us know by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. You will find our profiles linked in the podcast description. And thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Love this episode of the All for Literacy podcast? Subscribe, leave a review, and join the literacy conversation.